Hey, hello, Charlie. My name is Deborah Schwartz with the Mill Valley Historical Society, and I'm sitting here with Charlie Kelly, local resident, grew up in Mill Valley, a long time. How shall I say? How would you describe yourself, Charlie, as?
Well, the way my high school class described me is polymath because they couldn't figure out anything to pin me down with. So,
Okay, long
polymath
time, lifetime polymath
will do.
and local resident. Okay, so today, did I say the date is June 8th, 2015? And Charlie, let us begin, if you will, with a little bit about your family's history.
My mother and my father both grew up in relative poverty. My mother left home when she was 2 weeks after her 16th birthday. She left home. She graduated from high school at the age of 16 and left home immediately and made her way in the world. She graduated from junior college when she was 18, 2 weeks after her 18th birthday. She went to nursing school because it was something she could get a scholarship for, and she became a nurse. She took a job at Ross Hospital. My mom grew up in Arizona, went to junior college in Los Angeles, moved to Kansas for her nursing school, and made it back out to the West Coast to take a job in Ross Hospital in Ross, which was then a TB sanitarium. And
And this would have been what year? And your
in
mother's name,
1940,
please.
okay, 1940, she was 20 years old.
And your mom's name?
Frances Kelly. And Frances Blank was her Blanke, her maiden name. My dad is Charles Kelly, like myself. My mom took a job at the Marine shipyards during World War II because there was a big push on to build military equipment, and she became the nurse at the first aid station, and she was then just 22 years old. And my dad was actually a little older than draft age. He was born in 1908 and had served as a Coast Guard reserve, where he described his job to me as walking up and down the beach with a flashlight. And he became a welder at Marine Ship, building Liberty ships. And at one point, apparently, as I heard it, he burned himself. I wasn't there. He burned himself and had to go see the nurse, and kept seeing the nurse, and the rest is me. But my parents bought a house in Mill Valley in 1945, and they moved from that house, which is on Laverne, to the house that my mom still lives in, which is 36 Matilda in Mill Valley. And they bought that house for $4,500 in 1945. And I grew up in that house. It's the only house I have ever been aware of as the family home. And my dad was not educated, but he was very well read. He was not formally educated because he dropped out of school at the age of 13 to help support his mom.
And where did he grow up?
He grew up in Cincinnati, and when the Depression hit, he was just 20 years old, 21 years old, and he drifted across the country, spent some time in Portland running a, I believe it was a fur store, and then he took a job in San Francisco. Once again, working at a fur, luxury goods store on Market Street. And when the war started, obviously luxury goods were no longer a viable job, and everyone enlisted in the war effort. If you were not in the military, you were doing something for the war. And my dad once again became a welder over there at the Marine Ship. I'm amazed because I never saw him do anything like welding when I was
Marine
growing
Ship
up.
was in Sausalito, right?
Sausalito, correct. And there was actually another big yard in Richmond, building Liberty ships. The Bay Area was a big Liberty ship producing
The
area.
Victory and the Liberty
Right,
ships.
right. And I was obviously born in 1945. I have a brother younger, a sister older. We are all separated by a total of about 30 months, so we're all in consecutive classes in school. At Tam High, had three Kellys for 2 years. I was an indifferent student. I test off the charts, but I don't do homework. And the result is sea level. And so when I graduated high school, young men like myself generally at that time, middle class young men, smart like myself, went to college. I did not get into any kind of real college. I went to College of Marin, where the only reason I went there was because if you didn't go to college, you got drafted. And I failed that too, because I flunked out of College of Marin in rapid order and went and served 2 years in the United States Army, where I was never disciplined. I made E5, which is in 2 years, which is a pretty fast rise through the very minor ranks. I did not get in any personal danger. I served mostly in Texas and Arizona. And when I came out of the Army in 1968, I was a very rare commodity in the Bay Area, if you will, a healthy, robust young man who was not going to be drafted. And at that time, that is about 2 years after I'd gotten out of high school, all my contemporaries were either looking at another 2 years of college or the draft themselves, but robust young men without a draft problem were kind of scarce, and this rock band, friends of mine, needed someone like myself to handle equipment. The test for whether I could get the job, the guitar player said, "Can you and one other guy carry a Hammond organ up a flight of stairs?" And I said, "Show me a Hammond organ." And to show me the stairs, you want them up, you know? And I
Were you
could.
athletic and strong, or you
Well,
just?
interestingly, I was a terrible athlete. I was the last chosen for any team. I was not good at anything. I was 24 years old before I found the one thing I was really good at, and that's bicycling.
Yeah, oddly, I just interviewed Rob Mitoza, and he m mentioned that part of the surprise of you actually getting involved in something physical, but we'll get to that later.
All right.
Yes.
Well, anyway, I took a job with the Sons, and I was the roadie, drove all over
Sons of
Sons of
Champlin.
Champlin. Yes, I'm sorry. And I worked for those guys on and off. Well, every time they performed for the next 20 years, actually 40, I missed four shows in 41 years. And those four shows,
Wait, in 41 years?
42, it was 1968 to 2010. Although they didn't play continuously, they broke up for 20 years of that. So, I mean, I didn't,
So you were as a roadie
as a
for.
roadie, I did not miss a show. Well, I missed four, and I'll tell you which four. Bill Graham threw me out of the Fillmore in 1968, and so I didn't go to that show. And we were on tour with Three Dog Night in 1974, and we blew the engine on the truck, and someone had to stay with the truck to get it rebuilt, while the other guys rented a truck and kept up with the tour. And I lost the coin toss, I guess, but I missed three more shows, but I had an excuse for every one of them.
May I ask why Bill Graham threw you out?
You can ask, but it's pretty complicated.
Okay.
And I can tell you this, however. Now, every time, Bill actually called the manager of the band and said, "You got to fire this guy, Charlie Kelly." And the manager goes, "I'm not fired. We need a guy like that. You know, who do you think we got?" You know, and so, but he got over it. And we did many, many more shows for Bill Graham after 1968. And at every show that we did a Graham show, Mr. Graham would walk up to me and shake my hand, and that was it. We wouldn't have a conversation, but it was like, I'm the roadie for the Second Bill Band. Why, you know, what's it to you? But he was always very gracious after that. Apparently, I imprinted myself on him, and he saw that I wasn't going away anyway. So I don't have anything against Bill Graham. I understand that a lot of people do. I'm not one of them. So, but the issue is actually immaterial. It was just something that came up. And Bill Graham had quite a temper, and I got on the wrong side of it. And when I say Bill Graham threw me out, Bill Graham says, "Bruno, throw this guy out." You know? So
His
anyway,
henchmen
yes.
came to
And
escort
Bruno is a
you.
foot taller than Bill, you know. Anyway, yeah, that was the. And so in 1977, I thought that, you know, these guys are a great band. We're going to make money, and I'll be set for life because these guys are going to be a huge hit. Well, they weren't. And in 1977, stuff caught up, and they broke up. It was interesting to me that I had drawn much of my identity from the fact that I was associated with this popular group. And you, when you're in that position, you don't even know about your own resources. But there they were. Geez, you guys, you cut me loose, and now what am I going to do? Well, I found that I had other abilities, and one of my abilities was I organized people to do stuff. And so my cycling hobby became more paramount because I wasn't on the road all the time. And I started putting on these races for my friends with our crazy modified old Schwinns. And I became the de facto leader of, you wouldn't call it a large group, maybe 3 or 4 dozen people who were all fanatical about this. You'd have to call it a goofy hobby. And as we know now, that goofy hobby took over the world. But I was the ringleader of the few dozen that really kicked it off the top of the hill there.
We're talking mountain biking.
Yes, we are.
Yes.
And in fact, Bill Champlin was reading my book. I saw him a few weeks ago. And he says, "Charlie, I'm reading your book. Where was I when all this was going on?" And actually, I was working for those guys, but the only overlap between the two worlds was myself. You know, the rockers didn't ride the bikes. The bike riders didn't go to the rock shows. And I did fall in with I have to describe meeting Gary Fisher, because Gary Fisher and I we shared this adventure. And I was hanging out in 1971 with this girl who was a Grateful Dead fan. And she said, "You know, I know a guy. He's just like you. He hangs out with the Dead, and he's just a crazy hippie bike rider. And if you ever met the guy, you guys would get along great." So one day I'm riding along in San Anselmo, actually about half a mile from where I live now. And she called him Spider. She said his name was Spider. And I was, there was a guy, two guys on bikes, hippie guys on bikes, at a time when anybody on a bike was not, you know, bikes were not the thing then that they are now. And just somebody else on a quality bike got my attention. And this had to be, this guy was all legs and arms and hair. And if you're going to call a guy Spider, looked like a good candidate. And I rode up and I said, "Well, are you Spider?" And this girl Rose told me I should meet you. And he said, "Well, they call me Spidey because there's actually another guy who hangs out with the Dead goes by Spider. But my real name's Gary. And he's with another hippie guy and bearded, long-haired guy." And he said, "And this is Marmaduke, but his real name is John Dawson." And I go, "Well, hey, where are we riding? You guys are on bikes. I'm on bike. Where are we going?" And they told me that they were going down to the Grateful Dead office in San Rafael because John Dawson, a.k.a. Marmaduke, was the singer in a band called the New Riders of the Purple Sage, which had just recorded their first album, and Jerry Garcia played pedal steel on that album. And they were going down to the Grateful Dead office to look at cover art for this first New Riders album. And I kind of flashed my rock credentials, you know, "Hey, mm-hmm. man, I know these guys. Of course I do." So the essence...
These are all local performers. I mean,
well, they were
Bill
not...
Champlin and all these
sure,
people.
Sure, everybody... The Grateful Dead moved to Marin County, but they were Marin County at that time. Mm-hmm. And they were originally from the peninsula, but anyway, they were all living in Marin County by then, and they were not really the cult thing that they have become in the 40 some odd years since, because at that time they were one of many very popular bands: the Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver, Messenger Service, Creedence Clearwater. They were all Bay Area groups, and Grateful Dead were just one of them. So it wasn't quite like it would be now. Mm-hmm. And so we wound up, a few minutes after I met these guys, we wound up in the conference room at the Grateful Dead office, which was on Lincoln Avenue in San Rafael. Conference room was on the top floor, big table, and all these photographs and drawings and so forth are scattered across the table, and Marmaduke puts on their album, which I hadn't heard. It hadn't been released, and I was surprised. It was pretty good. And the bass player and Marmaduke are the only members of the band were there, and then Gary Fisher and I. And these two guys, the musicians, are asking Gary and me, well, I knew they knew Gary better than they knew me. They just met me. They're asking us what we think about these images. And I'm really thinking to myself, why do you guys care what I think about these? You know, what difference does it make to you? Because it's your band, your album, but the amazing thing to me is that Gary and I obviously did express preferences for these, some of the images we liked became the cover of that album. I saw it on the shelves like a month later. And the way things worked, I know that the decision, Marmaduke, had, somebody said, you got to come down and pick your cover art. And only two guys showed up to do it. They showed up with a couple of other guys, and that was the quorum. And I mean, it is astonishing to me that they asked my opinion, and even more astonishing that the stuff I liked wound up on their cover. But I'm not taking credit for it. Those guys pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
But it was an amazing thing to see because, like I said, it's your band. I just met you, you know. So anyway, that was meeting Gary Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of months later, I was at the flea market in Sausalito, and I was buying some furniture for this house I was renting in San Anselmo. And I was on my bike, and I didn't have any way to get back to San Anselmo, but I saw Gary there, and he had a truck. And I said, Gary, can I throw this stuff in your truck, and you can bring it up to my house in San Anselmo? He said, sure. So we put this table and four chairs in his truck. And I didn't see him for a week, and I'm going, ah, guy ripped me off for my table and $25 worth of furniture. But no, he showed up, finally shows up at the house, you know, and he looks around and goes, wow, who are you sharing this with? And I go, well, nobody right now. He says, need a roommate. And there we were, roommates. And we were roommates for the next 4 or 5 years in that house and another house up the street. So
where was that house?
That was on Humboldt Avenue. It was the first house with 21 Humboldt. And eventually that house got sold and we got kicked out. We moved to 32 Humboldt. And we moved without a truck. We just trudged up the hill, you know.
This is what year?
This would be about 1974 or 75, mm-hmm. I would imagine.
And you're how old then? You're
a senior? I was just under 30.
It just helps to get it cut.
Right. I was 28 years old at that point. And so anyway, we moved up the hill, and our house became really ground zero for the clunker stuff,
mm-hmm.
because we had eventually, a little while later, we had a third roommate named Alan Bonds. Alan is famous in the, if you will, clunker crowd because he perfected the craft of modifying old Schwinns.
Mm-hmm.
We were all doing it. We all had those, but Alan did the most beautiful work of any of us, and he would help other people set up their old clunkers, you know. And it's funny, the idea of going in business was not paramount. It's just because we built our own bikes at our house, and then people would say, hey, man, I can't do this. Can you help me? And so they'd come over, and at our house, we're always working on something, you know, building up somebody's bike, and that helped create the couple of dozen of those bikes that started the movement.
Can I just ask you to describe what it was like in your house? Was it one of those boy houses just with crap?
It was
everywhere?
A boy house. In the what other people would call the dining room.
Uh-huh.
Workbench, which was nailed to the wall. we ate in the kitchen, usually standing up. it was definitely boy
what
house.
What did the yard look like?
I didn't really have a yard. We had a deck. And that deck was just piled with used bike stuff. And then we had kind of a driveway area, gravel parking area behind the house. So it wasn't really a yard. It just was an open area, and we parked stuff there. But it didn't have a yard. And if we had a yard, it would have looked terrible. So we weren't the greatest of housekeepers.
But there was, I imagine, in your telling of the story, that there would have been a pooling of bicycle enthusiasts or people.
Gary and I were both the president of Velo Club Tam. We both served as president of Velo Club Tamalpais. And Velo Club Tamalpais was a bicycle club that I was an original member of. In 1971, there was one bicycle club in Marin County. It was Marin Cyclists. And we were a bunch of hippie, much younger, not in the same cultural page as most of the members of Marin Cyclists.
What were they?
They were older, they were straight, they had jobs. And we were kids, but we wanted to race our bicycles, Gary was already a bicycle racer. He was already a very good bike racer. But I wanted to race my bike. I'd found out the one thing I was good at, athletically, and it turns out that you couldn't race officially unless you're a member of a sanctioned club.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't want to join Marin Cyclists, which was a sanctioned club. And so a few of us, maybe a dozen or so, formed our own bicycle club, Velo Club Tamalpais, and just mostly so we could race our bikes, you know, but also so we could order cool matching jerseys and all that stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And we had...
And who did the... You had to have a letterhead and all that.
Yes, and the letterhead...
Where did that come from?
The letterhead and all our artwork was done by an artist named Kevin Happala. Kevin Happala was a guitar player whose brother played in a band closely associated with Clover called Flying Circus. Mm-hmm. And he was a great graphic artist. He designed our jerseys. He designed our letterheads and our business cards, and we had really, really nice stuff, far better than if you saw the real club, you know, you go, wow, you look better on paper. So, yeah, we had the
trades
services.
Or cash? Did you pay him?
Oh, I can't remember what we did for Kevin, but he did great work for us.
Uh-huh. Yes. So you're bona fide now.
Right, and at that point, I took up bicycle racing, and even though I was a pretty good bike rider, any sport you take up at the age of 27, the kids that took it up when they were 14 are going to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other half of my life was I was still working for a rock band, which meant that I had to get in my truck and drive for weeks at a time and then come back and ride bikes, and pretty much everybody else that races bikes rides them every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I raced one season just enough to find out that, you know, I couldn't do both. And one of them paid and one of them didn't. And then the other thing I found out is that bike racing is really hard. I mean, who knew that? You know, when you play basketball, half the people there get to win.
Yeah.
When you race bicycles, you never win. Somebody else always wins. And it's funny, the next... Well, after I found out I wasn't very, you know, competitive anyway, I was a pretty good bike rider, but not competitive at that level. I played on a recreational league basketball team, and we won the championship, and I felt better about my athletic ability, even in a bar league basketball team. But anyway, my racing career will not impress anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But
you were in the world.
I was, and... I got to appreciate, at least in part, what it must feel like to be in the big bike races. I mean, I know what it's like to ride in a big crowd with people bumping elbows, and I know what it's like to fall down in a big crowd and have three or four people ride over you, you know, so...
Are you wearing safety equipment back then?
Well, you're required to wear a helmet, and we referred to those helmets were commonly referred to as hairnets. And the old, if you look at it like a 60s bike racer, the helmets were just strips of leather that would keep your hair in place while you fractured your skull.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, hairnet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all that was required. The helmet requirements have stiffened considerably since then.
How about any kind of other?
Well, gloves, but everybody wore gloves.
And, riding pants?
Well, I mean, your bicycle shorts, which are essentially... Well, now they're even less than your underwear, but at that time they were scratchy old wool shorts.
Did they have pads in the butt?
No, are you kidding? Oh, well, they had, the crotch was padded for cycling, but the hips were not for when you hit the ground, you know, and so no, there was limited cycling, limited safety gear.
Because you see the pictures from the back in the day with fat tires and everybody's in jeans.
Well, of course, and okay, now when we started racing... we didn't call them mountain bikes, we called them clunkers.
Mm-hmm.
Why
did you call them clunkers?
Well, you got to call them something.
Yeah, but where did it come from?
I don't remember. I mean, they're just junk. I mean, it was junk. They were junk bikes. And the way that started, Gary and I were roommates,
mm-hmm.
and we had our fine Italian race bikes. But a nice Italian race bike is not really practical for going to the store. You got to wear the right shoes. You can't leave it outside, you know. And so Gary had a pile of stuff he'd mined out of the back of a closed bike shop. And out of this pile of parts, we put together a couple of old balloon tire, one-speed coaster brake bikes just for town bikes. I mean, we had no further goal other than you don't want to ride your Italian bike down to Safeway. So we had these one-speed cruiser bikes, and this friend of ours who lived up on top of a hill in Fairfax said, "You know, remember when we were kids, we used to ride our bikes on the trails. You remember that? And why don't you guys say throw the bikes in the truck and we'll go take them out on the trail, see if it's any fun." And I've told this story too many times. I'm pretty glib at it, but there were three of us and two bikes, because Gary and I had bikes, and then there's a guy with a pickup truck, and he drove us up there. And here's the trail, and it goes into Tamarancho. And I'm sure you're familiar with Tamarancho, but anyway, there's a trail. And so we started riding our bikes, two bikes up this trail, and two guys would ride and one guy would jog, you know. And when you're going uphill, that's no big deal. But so we rode maybe a couple of miles, right? And generally uphill until the hill got so steep, we thought, well, you know, I can't ride them anymore. We'd have to push. So let's turn back and turn around and coast back to the house. And then I found out that, you know, when you're going uphill, it's not much different jogging as it is for the guy riding. When you turn those bikes around, and even those, these are cheap bikes, so they're junk, they're total junk, it's more fun to ride that bike than it is to chase your friends while they laugh hysterically and ride away from you. So, even though the bikes were junk. So, almost immediately, we had to make a bike for the third party there, or their friend there. And so, because there was this trail there and handy to his house, and we all had these bikes, we started taking them out on the trails. And it was far more of a social event than it was an athletic event, because these bikes were heavy. You couldn't ride them very far up a hill, but it's really fun to go down the hill. So when you couldn't ride them anymore, you just pushed them. And, you know, half an hour of trudging up a hill, you're talking, you're chewing the fat, and you get to the top of the hill, and no one is any hurry to leave. You throw the frisbee around, you hang out for a while, and then you cruise back to wherever. And every ride, at least in our geographical area, every ride pretty much ends with a downhill. I mean, everything out of Fairfax is up, and everything back to Fairfax is down. And what started happening as these rides got bigger and bigger, the downhills got very competitive. But when there's seven or eight of you coming off the top of the hill, whoever is the most aggressive is going to be the first to the bottom. And it's not because he's the most skilled, but because he has less concern for your well-being than
Perhaps
you
his
do.
own.
And he will ride you right off the edge of the road if it's necessary. But anyway, so we talked about it for a while. We thought let's have a race. Let's finally, you know, sort this all out without anyone, you know, we'll find out who's fastest. And
Is it all dudes here or all guys?
it was all guys except Wendy Craig always came on all the rides. She lived next door to Fred, the guy who had the pickup truck. So she and her husband Larry Craig, who well, anyway, they got bikes too, and Wendy was far more into it than her husband Larry, who actually had to go to work on a regular basis. And so Wendy started joining our crew. But we talked about it for a while, and we thought, well, let's have a race. And we knew the hill, the repack. Our rides had led us. We learned a lot about the geography of Marin County by just riding around on all these trails. And we found this one fire road that came down a really steep hill, and it ended right in Fairfax. And if we're going to have a race, well, that seemed like the great place to do it. And I was familiar with regular bike racing. I said, you know, we'll do it as a time trial so that you don't have the problems of a lot of people on the, you know, everybody can, they call it the race of truth in professional bike racing. It's the race of truth. The time trial means there's no strategy. How fast are you? You know, and the other people are immaterial. They're not there. So we rounded up some timepieces, some pretty funky timekeeping equipment, but we had a race, and that was on October 21st, 1976. And there were about six or seven of us there. Unfortunately, the document recording who was there? Oh my goodness.
Let me just pause this. All right, we had a brief pause there, now back to it.
In 1976, we took these timepieces, and a few of us went up on this hill, and I discovered something about athletic competition that I hadn't realized yet, and that is that every championship has to be defended. That is, Alan Bonds, my roommate at the time, won the race, and we found that first our equipment was not very reliable, that when you're doing as much as you can on it, things failed. And also we found that sometimes when you're going as fast as you can, you fall down too. So the bottom line is that we held another race 4 days later because, hey, that was so much fun. And besides, you know, everybody else wants a shot at the champion, you know, a shot at the title, if you will. And so we held another race 4 days later, and it's more than the competition, what I found out, because I was not the fastest rider. I was fast enough, but there were guys, Gary Fisher and Joe and a few other people, much quicker than I was. But there is almost no way in the modern world that you can turn on the adrenaline pump and leave it on for that long. I mean, you can skydive, you can surf. Those are all similar, you know, adrenaline junkie sports. But this was 5 minutes of everything you have. And most sports, 5 minutes of maximum effort, your stamina is gone. But this is downhill. And so, you know, you...
So you're not exerting physically, but mentally.
Right. And you have to be sharp, obviously. And there is something separating the winners from the losers. But it is just an amazing thrill because we got very, very familiar with the road, you know, and we did everything we could to improve our time. So we walked up and down it, to study the turns because, a lot of the turns are blind, and if you know what's on the other side, you can maximize your speed through the turn. And it was immediate. By then, we'd been riding clunkers for a couple of years, and I immediately wanted a secret weapon, which was, hey, let's build a bike just for this. And I asked a friend named Craig Mitchell if he would, you know, build a bike out of modern tubing, but to duplicate essentially the Schwinn that clunkers that we were then riding. And he did. And for some reason, I was unhappy with the product. And I sold it back to him. And boy, that would have been a collectible bike. Beyond collectible. But I have no idea where it is. And the gentleman who made it is no longer with us, so we won't ever know where that bike went. Mm-hmm. And after that experience, my friend Joe Breeze, had taken a frame building course and he'd built road bikes for some of the guys in our club. And you have to understand, we talk these things to death. You know, you talk about you when you're not riding, you're talking about riding. You're talking about what you're riding. You're talking about every aspect of what we were doing, and we talked bike design to death. And it was clear that there was one guy in our club could probably build a bike for this purpose, and that was Joe. So one day I'm out riding on my clunker, and here's Joe coming the other way on his, and it was actually right in the middle of San Anselmo, and I pinned him down. I said, Joe, what would it take for me to talk you into building a bike for this, you know what we're doing? What would it take? And he said, I don't know, a few $100 anyway. I need to buy tubing and whatever. And I had $300 in my pocket, and he had it in his hand a couple of seconds later. And I said, well, let's go. And if you know Joe, once he accepts an obligation, he will complete that obligation. And it would take three times as long as you thought it would. Because when Joe completes an obligation, there is nothing left to chance. And it actually took quite a while for me to get that bike. It was probably 8 or 9 months because, as I've explained quite often, when you build a road bike, there's a lot of history and there's a lot of, lore and whatever that these things have been around for a while, and so you can look and see what other people have done. There was no precedent, there was no model, there was no nothing for Joe to work from, and he, being the careful guy that he is, he spent a month on the drawing board before he ever got around to.
This is more than just a job. This is a personal challenge,
This,
Dave.
that's right. And by the way, Joe Breese has never had a job in his life. He didn't go to a minute of college. And he is a world-class engineer. And
Where did he go to high school? Did he do the shop
Cam,
class? Because I know Steve
he grew
Potts
up
is a friend of
on
mine, and
by the golf course there.
he said that Steve Potts,
Right.
he said that he acquired his skill at at Tam High shop class. That's where he learned a lot of his abilities.
Joe tells me that he took every mechanical drawing class that they taught at Tam High. And to this day, the guy is just does beautiful graphic work. He could, if he ever wanted a job, he could have a job doing that, but you'd have to wait a lot long time for the product.
Hey, let's just put a plug in for Joe's new museum here.
Oh yes, well, why not? Joe is about bikes in every aspect of cycling, and he's competitive, but he wants to put bikes under people for transportation. And Joe has spearheaded, he's one of five people really working on the museum, but Joe is by far the genius behind it. And not that the other people aren't big contributors, but it's Joe's vision, really. And the museum is a magnificent, magnificent effort. And it encompasses the mountain biking thing that Joe and I and our friends took part in, but it's about much more than that. It's about the history of cycling, the future of cycling, and also as a community center for all kinds of good works, if you will. He designed the building so you can give lectures there, you can show films there, you can use that as a base to present all kinds of different lectures or films or whatever.
And
And
that's in
it's in
Fairfax.
Fairfax, yes, in the it's, it used to be a grocery store, and they've taken over the building, and as you know, Deborah, done a beautiful job of layout of the, you can see that Joe thinks everything through.
Real museum quality presentation.
Right. And Joe is living his dream as a curator of a bicycle museum, and Joe dreams big and he also delivers, you know?
Really fun opening
Yeah.
yesterday,
Oh,
by the
yeah.
way. Good
Yeah.
music, good food, the whole thing. Okay, so back to the 8 months it took you to
Okay.
actualize this.
And during that time, other people got onto the what Joe was doing for me, and he took eight more orders for bikes. And so with his bike, that was a total of 10 bikes. He built 10 bikes. His was the first to be completed, and mine the second, like 4 or 5 months later. Joe was on his right away. But and he won the repack race on his bike on the first
So you
time
come to
out.
him with the idea, he builds himself a prototype, and then
Right.
he builds you one.
Right. And
So this
then he built
is
eight more for
so
other
you're the
people.
mother and father of these bikes.
Well, I mean, I had the idea and the money. Joe was the guy that could execute, and whatever my fame is in the cycling world is not as an engineer. And Joe is the engineer. He is one of the finest bicycle engineers in the world because he comes from an engineering background. His dad built race cars, and he has been a machine, had a machine shop in his house. Took all those drawing courses, so Joe is just—he's a self-taught engineer. When he built his house in Fairfax, he did the architecture for it. I mean, who does that? When the town of Fairfax needed to rebuild the bridge that approaches Joe's house, Joe did the engineering for it, and Of course, the town architect signed off on it, but it's well known that Joe did not go to college to learn this stuff, you know. I mean, he does not have an engineering degree. He's just really good. So anyway, and I have to tell you how I met Joe, by the way, because Joe has been my dear friend for 45 years. My friend Fred and I were driving Highway 37 over near Novato, and here's this guy hitchhiking, and he looked like he'd just escaped from ZZ Top. He had a beard, he had hair down to there, and it was Joe Breeze, and he was like 18 years old, and he had a beard down to the third button on his shirt. I can't believe this, you know. I can't grow that beard yet. And but anyway, we pick up the hitchhiker. Well, somehow Joe and I established our bicycling passion, our mutual bicycle passion, like within a few miles of getting in the vehicle, you know. And Joe has been my friend absolutely ever since, you know, because it's impossible to dislike Joe. The guy is the most honest, ethical person I have ever met. I wish I could live up to his personal standards, but I fall far short.
So, and meanwhile, what about Spider?
Well,
The guy
Spidey and
Gary
I,
gives
Gary and
you.
I were sharing the house and building these clunkers up. And Gary was actually, he was working as a mechanic on a bike race team in Europe when we had our first repack races. He wasn't even around for those. But when he came back, I think he didn't get into the first his first race till we'd done four or five already. But when he came back, he was immediately competitive. And in fact, Joe and Gary were by far the most successful at repack over the 24 races that were held.
So so these names, Joe Breeze, Gary Fisher,
Right.
these people that may be listening to this interview, they're going to know those names
Of
because
course they
those are the
are.
bikes that they buy.
That's right.
They were
In
people for
fact,
you, but they're bikes to everybody else.
every bike in my backyard has one of my friends' names on it.
What are the names on your bikes in your backyard?
Three, Fisher, Breeze, and Richie. And I'll have to introduce Tom Ritchie. After Joe had built the bike for me, and
Is
for
it the,
eight,
do you have the original bike?
well, it's in the museum,
Yeah.
but it's at Joe's house right now, actually. But after Joe built that bike, it was clear that that was the direction that a lot of people wanted to go. And everybody also realized, man, it took you a year to get your bike after you gave Joe some money, you know. And Gary, we'd gone out to Crested Butte because, well, boy, is this a disjointed story. But anyway, we'd gone out to Crested Butte, and Gary had taken his old Schwinn, and Joe and Wendy Craig and I were all on Breezer bikes. Well, we got into Aspen after this big gnarly ride, and the handlebar on Gary's old Schwinn just breaks right off. And it wasn't lost on Gary that, wow, good thing we finished the ride before that happened, you know,
Yes.
and also that maybe this technology is kind of dated. So
Yeah.
Gary obviously had to catch up. But he also knew that, boy, it's going to take a long time if you have Joe do it, because Joe takes a long time. And Gary knew a couple of frame builders, a guy named Jeffrey Richmond in Santa Rosa, and Tom Ritchie, who lived in Palo Alto. And so Gary hedged his bet. He ordered two bikes from each of those guys, and he figured, well, whoever delivers first, I'm going to get a bike, and then I'll find some people to buy the other ones, because there were a few other people who were expressing interest in this. And so Tom Ritchie delivered first, and so Gary got a bike from Tom. Tom built three. Tom built one for himself, one for Gary, and then one for a friend of Gary's who had been expressing interest. So Tom built three bikes, and then the other frame builder came through a couple of weeks later, and Gary found people to buy those bikes. And once again, we got on with our lives, and now we got cool bikes to ride anyway. And let's see. Okay, about a month and a half later, Gary calls me and said, "Hey, Charlie, you got to come over and check this out." He'd moved into another house by that time. And so I went over to his house, and He opened the trunk of his car and he showed me that Tom had built nine more of these frames, but Tom Ritchie was not part of our circle. He lived 50 miles south. He was heavy duty cyclist, but he didn't have any connection to this market for these kind of bikes. And he thought, well, these bikes are easy to build. And boy, he got rid of three of them pretty quick. And but he found that he had no connection with the people that might want to buy them. So he, in desperation, he turned to Gary and said, "Look, Gary, can you unload these bikes for me?" So Gary calls me and shows me these bikes, which are just beautiful. And I says, "You want to help me sell these bikes?" And your entire life pivots on the answer to that question. And I said, "Yes."
Wait, did he actually say that? Your
He said, "You
entire
want to help me sell these bikes?"
but you know, but he didn't say your life pivots on this. I mean,
No,
this is
I know.
what, this is
I'm
just
just
you
telling you now
understanding that
that
right now.
it's a casual question with a casual answer,
With a
and
very
things turn in amazing directions on very small events.
which you cannot know at the
Of course,
moment.
of course. And in fact, there was no way at that time to imagine or fathom what mountain biking became, because once again, at the time, it was a goofy hobby. It was expensive to get into at the level that we these bikes sold for more than Italian race bikes because they were harder to put together. Italian race bikes at the time, you could call a bike distributor and get all the parts that come on a race bike because they're familiar with the product and all those parts are all worked out and available. But we were in new territory, so one part would come from some one place and another from another, and at first we just walked into the bike store and bought the stuff over the counter, which is like building a car by going down to the auto parts store and buying one part at a time, and pretty expensive way to build a car and also expensive way to build a bike. But we put a very high price on these bikes, as high as we could figured we could get away with, which was $1,300 in 19, what was it, 70, 78, $79, $1,979, pretty expensive bikes, more than an Italian race bike. And but we found that the market was unlimited. And so Gary and I rented a garage in Fairfax and started building our bikes. And I have to say that almost, I had some very cool adventures along the way, but for about 5 or 6 months, it was me and my best friend building the coolest bikes in the world. And who gets to do that for a minute? Who gets an experience like that for it? Because we knew what we had. We knew there is nothing like what we're building. And of course, other frame builders were picking up on it. It's not like we were going to corner the market, but it turned out that Tom Ritchie could crank these things out by the dozens, where it took Joe a year to make 10, Tom Ritchie whipped out 25 in a month, and we, through an accident of just who we hooked up with, and just our own individual contributions, we had the right team in place at the right time to put this stuff on the world. Now, we got into this without a business plan. I mean, Gary said, "You want to help me sell these bikes?" And that was our business plan. And so there was no structure to our company. There's no way to say who was getting the profits, which didn't matter because there were no profits. We lost money continually. But anyway, it was the right people for the time, but the seeds of destruction were already there because we didn't have a business plan. We didn't have a coherent, we didn't know what the market was going to be. And in about 4 years, the inherent problems with not having a structure to your company caught up. And at that time, we were deeply in debt. And Gary comes from a fairly well-off family. And so he and his dad bought me out of the company because I was unhappy, from that 6 months where, boy, I couldn't get to the place early enough. Well, when the problems stack up, when every day you got to deal with the fact that you owe thousands and thousands of dollars and don't have any way to come up with it, puts a lot of pressure on you, and it really was hard on the relationship. And so anyway, they offered me the way out, and I took it. And by then, I was, I had this other adventure going on. I started publishing a magazine.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the magazine now.
I was about to.
Yeah.
In 1980.
Let's right into that.
Okay. In 1980, our experience with the Road Bike Club led us to believe that maybe there is a place for a mountain bike club. And so we had a meeting at Wendy Craig's house, and we thought, we picked a grandiose name. We were going to be the Marin County Wilderness Wheelers, right? And, okay, what do you do with your club? What is the purpose of a club, right? Okay, somebody said, we should have a newsletter. All right, who can do a newsletter? Well, Charlie, you sold some magazine articles, you know. You can write stuff. And my girlfriend at the time was this woman, Denise Caramagno, and you might have met her the other day. She was at the opening. But she said, we call it the Fat Tire Flyer. And, of course, that would just put everyone on the floor. Of course we are going to call it the Fat Tire Flyer. So Denise and I put out this photocopied newsletter for, a couple of dozen people. And the irony is that it's not like there's a lot of news in there for people already knew each other. And what are you going to tell people
it's
that aren't, you know?
So a really charming concept, though.
Right. But anyway... we made a big mistake. On the very first issue, we put issue number one. Well, what does that imply? Mm-hmm. Issue number two. And so people said, when's issue number two coming out? Well, the club never had another meeting. But the newsletter took on a life of its own. Mm-hmm. And so Denise and I gradually learned the craft of publishing because, come on, photocopying is easy. I mean, this thing didn't look as nice as the average PTA newsletter, mm-hmm. you know. But we learned it, and after about 7 issues, we moved from the photocopied to getting it professionally printed, and then we got a graphic artist to help us with the layout, and it started looking quite a bit better. A couple of years into that, Denise and I parted girlfriend-boyfriend company, and it got difficult because you're trying to do a business with someone that you have this heavy-duty stuff going on, you know. And so she wound up selling her interest to a guy that I didn't even know till then. So I had a partner, half-owner, that, you know, that's the way it is, you know. So, once again, like the mountain bike business, there was no structure, no agreement who does what. I was writing pretty much everything. I was doing the layout, handling the subscriptions, and the other guy was writing checks out of his inheritance and basically going through it. But we struggled along because in spite of the fact that we were not very good at it, we had no competition. Mm-hmm. It's the only publication for this market.
Some of these photographs from the publications are included in your book.
Oh yes, in fact, I can leave you a few copies. I don't know if that matters to you.
We haven't really even come to the part of what we're talking about. All of this, which is much of this, is included in a book you've written.
Of course.
A publication of the actual. What you're talking about now, your publication, your newsletter.
Let me get to that in a minute here. But when big magazine companies started seeing the demographics of mountain biking, and by about 1986, 87, mountain bikes were outselling road bikes, mm-hmm. and that's just too juicy for all the other. And so once the real publishers with real money and real ability got into the game, we were done. Because, we were just a couple of guys making it up as we went along. And Rodale Press, well, those guys can put out magazines, you mm-hmm. know. And so their first effort would be beautiful. So anyway, it had a time, it had a place, and it's over. Mm-hmm. So 1980...
It ran its course.
That's right. 1987, I walked away from it, and I don't regret... I don't regret doing it. Don't want to do it again. Mm-hmm. You know, a magazine is merciless. As soon as you put one to bed, there's another one to think about. Mm-hmm. And there's never any respite from it. I have a friend, Maurice Tierney, who publishes Dirt Rag, and he's in his 26th year. And I'm going, man, I do not know how you do it. You know, you got something in you that I don't. But anyway, in 1987, I got an offer, 86, 87. Anyway, I got an offer from an English publisher. His name is Richard Ballantyne, and he's from the Ballantyne Books family. And he put out bicycle books in England, and he had me write a mountain bike book. And I whipped it out in a month, and I've been trying to atone for that for many, many years because it sucked. I'm sorry. What I found was the
what
English...
What was it called?
What's that? It's called Richard's Mountain Bike Book by Charlie Kelly. Because this guy with Richard Ballantyne, he had a series of books, bicycling books. And so anyway, the version distributed in England was beautifully printed. The version distributed in the United States was not. It was embarrassing. It was the images were terribly done. The artwork was distressing. It was just, man, I finally wrote a book and I hate it. You know, I mean, gosh. Think about that moment in your life. You know, boy, you finally got a book. You wrote a book.
I'm an author.
Too bad it
and
sucks.
I'm embarrassed.
So, anyway, I wrote for a number of all the United States bicycle publications. I had editorial positions with several of them, but in 1990, a week after my daughter was born, Bicycling Magazine fired me, and they just I just pink slip in the mail. I mean, they were headquartered in Pennsylvania. My title was West Coast Editor because, well, if you're going to write about mountain bikes, you pretty much got to have somebody at ground zero, you know. And the other side of that is that, having done my own magazine, I was highly critical of the complete lack of imagination you find in corporate publications. And I'm not sure what it was that caused them to fire me, but I remember that I got really tired of the cliche cover photos, which are all shot with a 300 millimeter lens. If we can have splashing water and flying hair, you know, but it's like I photocopied a dozen magazine covers that were all essentially the same photo with different people. And I said, you know, any problem with imagination here? I mean, because the thing about the Fat Tire Flyer, and I'll show you, every cover got your attention. Mm-hmm. And no two looked alike, and they were not cliches. But anyway, maybe that was it. I have no idea what it was, but I was clearly off the reservation. And I got fired with, I mean, it was just short of my email, you know. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I thought, well, my daughter is now a week old, and I just lost the juicy job that I had. So I had to go do that piano moving thing again, mm-hmm. you know, and which I did for the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. And because even though the empire is microscopic, I couldn't be fired from it, and I ran it myself. You know, I mean,
That's the name of your business?
No, it was Kelly Moving.
Kelly
oh, yeah.
Moving.
There you go.
Yeah.
And
Well, because, right, now I'm seeing your hat. Kelly Moving with the piano keys on.
Yes, yes.
Nice.
But anyway, I just had a piano moving company, and I moved pianos because, like I say, you can't get fired from it. They won't send the job to Taiwan, you know. The world won't run out of pianos.
Pause. Okay.
One of the aspects of my funky little magazine and also writing for the various other publications, because I wrote for pretty much every major bicycle publication in the United States at that time, and a couple in England and other countries. And the upshot is that I had a written record of many of the things that I took part in. And only later did it turn out to be, you know, a valuable record of an era that we won't see again. And so I have heard so much disinformation and oversimplification of this lengthy and complex process that led to mountain biking that I knew that as a first person participant, I could explain it better than anyone who just read about it somewhere else, and mostly read my stuff anyway, but and it's it there's nothing that irritates me more than the phrase invented the mountain bike, because we didn't invent the mountain bike. What we invented was a sport, and the sport created the machinery for it. You know, I mean, once we started racing downhill, then it was going to go in that direction. You know, if you, as long as you continue doing this, you're going to have to think about what you're doing it on, and it led inevitably in that direction. What we came up with was this goofy hobby of downhill racing, and that drove everything else. But the idea of inventing the mountain bike, the bike already existed. The mountain bike, modern mountain bike, isn't a lot different from bikes that have been around for a long time, although they're thought in a, the thoughts, they're designed differently, but really all the elements have been around forever. And it's not so much that the mountain bike was invented. A culture was created that made a mountain bike necessary to be part of that culture. And it's a very important distinction. And, you know, I don't make any claim to, you know, I won't even say the phrase, but I won't make any claim. I know that I was a ringleader of a cultural group who eventually came up with this idea. And so anyway, I it's a complex process. It took me 264 pages to explain it. And I was the only person who really could, because I have file cabinets and file cabinets full of all the stuff that I generated all over those years. I have every magazine article that came out about it. So no one else could really write that book. And well, Joe could write it, but he won't. And and I even said that to him, Joe, you could write a pretty good book, but you'd never finish it. And he said, well, that's why I'm making sure yours is the one I want to see. You know, so Joe would, by the way, a huge assist on my book, and he wrote the foreword. I wouldn't have anyone else write the foreword for me.
A couple things I want to ask you about this. In your writing, you didn't go to college, really.
No.
How did you become, I mean, is it a natural ability?
Apparently, because the first article I ever sold, I was on the road, I was still on the road with the band, and we had this like crazy downhill race. And the other roadie, we're in San Diego, and the other roadie, he'd been up a little later than I had, and so I was going to have to wait a couple of hours for this dude to wake up so he'd get in the truck and go somewhere, you know. And I just sat around the motel room and started like writing down about this thing that was so exciting in my life then, you know. And I wrote a story, and I wrote it in a notebook first, and I went home and actually typed it up. Well, Gary was at the time working at Bicycling Magazine, and he said, let me take this with me when I go back to Pennsylvania. And he dropped it on someone's desk somewhere, and they said, hey, we'll buy it. This is pretty interesting, you know. And so I sold the first article I ever wrote without even really submitting it. Uh-huh. Okay. And then, let's see, that would have been 1978. And then Outside Magazine, I don't remember how I hooked up with Outside Magazine. They asked me, or somebody who was associated with them asked me if I would write this up, and I did, and that was a pretty good payday. Mm-hmm. I sold the first three or four articles I ever wrote with no rejections. Uh-huh. You know, I two rejections, I probably would have done something else, you uh-huh. know, but it turned out that I could string words together, and functionally literate anyway. And I'm not trained. I actually flunked English 1A, which...
Remember when you spoke at the first Wednesday and your English teacher showed?
Oh, yeah, Mr. Wallace, of course. Well, he lives on Sunnyside here in Mer-
yes,
Mer Valley.
Yes, but nonetheless.
But yes, of course. I'm very proud to be able to do that.
Did you flunk his class?
No, but when I went to College of Marin, one of the classes that I did flunk was English 1A, and to pass English 1A, you have to write a 500-word essay. Uh-huh. Well, I could knock that out right now, writing behind my back and not looking at it, you know, but at that time, a 500-word essay defeated me, and I wouldn't have a problem with it now.
So, really, when I'm just listening to your whole story, what seems most apparent to me is that your passions have fueled your excitement about what you were doing, the camaraderie you had with friends, the life that you were living has fueled the...
Well, I have no way of measuring my passion against anyone else's. However, I know that I do stuff that other people never think about doing, you know, and it was interesting that when I was a roadie for the band, well, hey, the leadership is at the other end of the spectrum there, you know. I was not the leader of that thing. But when it came to the clunker riders and putting on the races and just rounding up the people to do stuff, it turned out that I had this natural leadership ability that I wasn't even aware of. Mm-hmm. And I could organize events. And so I organized the races. I also organized the Clunker Awards, which I have to tell you about. 1977, we'd been racing at Repac for a year, and we thought, let's have a really big party for all the people that to take part in this, whatever, the 30 or 40 people that even know about this stuff. And so rather than just have a dinner, I thought, well, let's have an awards banquet, you know, and we'll give awards to all the people that do this stuff. And in fact, we'll figure out the people, and then we'll figure out the awards that we need to give them. You know, I mean, it's that much, that bogus, you know.
You're not creating like, your own scene here.
Right. And so Wendy Craig did these amazing, she's a fabric artist, and she made these soft cloth awards, and I can't describe them other than each one of them took her many, many hours, and I could never make her do that again, but okay. And so we rented the Women's Club in Fairfax, ordered up mountains of food and beer and all oysters and everything. Well, I'm the master of ceremonies. I got my tux. We are really going to do this up. And so I'm over at the Fairfax Lumber picking up the charcoal to barbecue the oysters, and I'm driving the piano moving truck. The door comes down on my hand and severs the tip of this finger here. It's back on, but it changed my focus immediately. I'm getting ready to go to the dinner and be like the focus, the star of the show, and putting on my own show. Now I got to go to the hospital and get my finger sewed back on. Uh-huh. And I ran to the hardware store spurting blood, you know, and hey, call 911, please, you know, and a cop car shows up seconds later, and he says, I called an ambulance. I said, screw the ambulance, let's go, you know. And so I jump in the car, and he sirens me right down to Ross Hospital, and I come, you know, he radios ahead, so he comes skidding to a stop in the parking lot there or by the ER, and some guys were the gurney run one way, and I ran past him going the other way. And I said, you know, I got to deal with this because, you know, I got some stuff going on tonight. And, so they call in the hand surgeon. And I said, look, you know, I don't suppose I could use a phone while you're doing this. Calm down. You're in shock. You're hysterical. You know, like, we understand you're injured. You know, I go, what? 80 people are arriving in a building. And the charcoal and the tables and the rented, you know, silverware is in a truck parked by a lumber shop, you know, lumber store. And so I got to at least tell somebody where the stuff is, go get it, you know. And so while the guy is sewing the tip of this finger back on, I'm using the phone with my other hand and issuing orders to people all over Fairfax. And then the guy says, okay, well, you're sewed back on, but you better hold this up above your shoulder level. You want to keep the fingertip. Well, it is the middle finger of my left hand. It had an enormous white bandage on it. And so I got back to that place, and there's my date, and I got my tuxedo. And from the lectern, doing this awards banquet, I flipped this enormous white bird to the crowd. That's right. And I got to hold this up, guys. And by the way, I'm not taking any pain meds because I'm drinking wine tonight, because everybody's bringing the 25-year-old bottles for the big party. And if I take any downers, I'm going to be face down. Yeah. And so anyway, I couldn't take any painkillers. I just gutted it out and did my thing. And we actually had another awards banquet the next year. But after that, I was got the bike company, and it was a different world. But we did two of those awards banquets. And the second time, got through it a little
intact.
easier. Yes.
Well, one thing we haven't talked about here, but it's an absolutely essential element of this entire experience, is Mount Tam, the region itself. And we here I am, a representative of the Mill Valley Historical Society, and I like to think about how an area forms people and people form an area, and Mount Tam has done her part.
Well, there are certainly a lot of recreational users, and we, before a lot of that stuff was even thought of to be off limits, we were on those trails that are now off limits, but they weren't then, because no one had thought, who's going to ride a bike up here, you know? And of course, maybe we're the reason that some of those trails are off limits, but there are trails that I can ride. And now it's a bit reactionary. Maybe in the 80s, there was quite a bit of, pushback, but the demographics have evolved quite a bit. And now it's seen as a middle to upper class sport. And the aficionados are, in many cases, professional people with, responsible citizens, not like those crazy hippies without jobs, you know. And so the demographics have evolved quite a bit, and the pushback has, it's not like it went away, but it has softened up, and it's now seen as something that, you know, can we all get along or whatever you want to say,
right.
You know, but
hikers versus bikers.
Right. Well, I don't like to see it as an antagonistic thing, you know, and certainly I've said for whatever 30 years or so that every hiker you meet when you're on your bike, you might as well assume you are the ambassador for your sport, because they don't remember the nice ones. They don't remember the ones that weren't. And so be an ambassador for your sport with everyone you meet, because they're only going to remember the people they didn't like, you know.
Well,
so,
you know, I own a hiking tour business.
Oh, yeah, we know that.
And
yeah.
I consider bikers, I've described them as natural mountain phenomenon. I call you all biker birds.
Right.
And there is a condition that rarely you may encounter called, made up, agromania.
Oh, yeah.
And there are a few out there, and it is very rare. But my feeling is that we are all out there loving the mountain.
Right.
And we take care of each other. And if we see biker birds, we step aside and make space for them as we would any natural phenomenon, deer, mountain lions. Coyotes.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this: have you seen personally any evolution in the in your time? Here in Marin, have you seen the evolution of that particular vis-a-vis, shall we say? The bicycles and the pedestrians. Have you? You're looking at it from a different angle, you know. And I'm just wondering: have you personally experienced any evolution in that regard?
You mean as far as people getting along better?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I think that personally I do, because I live it.
Right.
I wave and if need be of assistance to any biker out there. Every biker is somebody's child. Every biker is somebody that has feelings and thoughts.
Right.
And my obligation as a human being on that mountain is to help everybody stay safe, and if that means I step aside because they're riding on loose soil, then I will happily step aside.
Sure.
And hopefully I think bikers now, as the sport has become, you know, I think in the early years for you, the biking as a sport, they didn't, a lot of the bikers didn't expect to see people out on some of the trails they were on, but now we're, you know, we're aware that everybody's out there. And occasionally there is this one horrible encounter that you will have with an individual. That is no different than an encounter you may have with a hiker that has agromania.
Well, I didn't mean to interview
yes,
you, but anyway, I'm interested in that aspect. But I personally feel like there have been quite a bit of evolution in that relationship, you know. And
and you talk to the local bike shops, and they want to know who's acting out on the mountain.
Right, right.
And if this for people listening, if you should encounter somebody who's recklessly riding their bike on the mountain or putting others in peril or themselves, it's good to go to your local bike shop and give them that information,
right,
because
right.
bike shop owners know who's riding,
right?
And it's good, and bike shop owners want to be responsible and caring about their
clientele.
And they
have a vested interest, for sure.
Yeah, so I think nowadays there's a lot more interest in everybody getting along, and you know, I think really it starts and stops with your feeling about sharing the mountain, any individual's feeling about sharing the mountain.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, when you talk about geography, Fairfax is uniquely situated to be a cycling town. Now, Davis, California, is dead flat, and it's a cycling town because of that.
Yes.
And also the young population as university students. But Fairfax is a popular destination for both road cyclists and for mountain bikers. And most places that where cycling is popular, it's one or the other. But Fairfax is uniquely situated here in the Bay Area, where it's a good destination for the road cyclists. It's a jumping off point for the mountain bikers, and the result is that every weekend, and you've seen this, Fairfax has hundreds of cyclists.
Well, we're in Mill Valley here. I'm with the Mill Valley Historical Society.
Right.
It's exactly the same here. Mm-hmm. I think that the fact is, Mount Tam was fertile ground for the creation of mountain bikes because of the topography.
Right.
And that is why.
Well, and demography, demographics, and topography, and cultural. I mean, it was a lot of forces in play, and you can analyze them later. You don't know that they are there when you're taking part. You know, but we can see now from this perspective that there are quite a bit of, you know, we live in an urban area, and we live in a place close to a major metropolitan center, but with trails and undeveloped areas, and it's got to be one of the biggest undeveloped places with that kind of proximity to metropolitan areas, you know. And so, once again, that's unique demographics of Marin County, geography of Marin County that helped lead us in this direction.
And just in adding on to this, Charlie, I just would like to say that we have 85 miles of open space from San Francisco.
Okay.
This area was protected and salvaged in various ways by locals,
right?
Not agencies.
Well, a good example would be Tamarancho. Now, Tamarancho, I started going there when I was about 9 years old, and I was a Cub Scout. It's Boy Scout camp, and they would have the summer programs where you'd ride a bus from Mill Valley to Tamarancho, and you'd make lanyards and swim and hike and tie knots and all that stuff, and then the bus would bring you home and let your mom off the hook for the day, And then while I was Boy Scout, my Boy Scout troop camped up there. And now, of course, it's a mountain bike destination.
Mm-hmm.
And because Tamarancho represents, I don't know how big it is, thousands of acres for sure, a huge undeveloped tract, once again, very close to major metropolitan area, there was a lot of pressure on the Boy Scouts to, you know, a lot of people would like to own that property.
Yes.
And the Boy Scouts is not exactly a A-list, blue chip company. So the mountain bikers actually, I believe, have saved Tamarancho for the Boy Scouts, because the mountain bikers said, look, we'll build the trail, and the trail will be in all the places you guys don't go anywhere anyway, because the trail pretty much works the perimeter of the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the Boy Scouts hang out in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And so this subscription or membership thing generates quite a bit of money for the Boy Scouts and helps them preserve their own activities there. And so it's a real win-win.
Wonderful.
You know? And the irony being, that's where I first took my, town bike out on a trail. But I bet I was there for a Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts and took my town bike. And now I go out there and I got a little thing to hang on my bike that says I can ride there, and the trails are great, So
wonderful.
Yeah,
wow.
So it's just an example of the unique geography that has helped us out here.
You've certainly had quite a ride here.
I'm not sure it's done, but
No, not yet, so far. So as we get closer to the end of this interview, we talked about your early years here, growing up here, people that you've known, the adventures that you've embarked upon. What haven't we talked about? What's the one thing
I have a
I
family. I do have a family.
Yes,
And
tell me.
I have been married, as I mentioned, for 29 years to the same individual. And we have a daughter who is just does nothing but please me. And she was straight A's through high school, honors in college, works in Los Angeles in a public relations firm where she's making more than her mom and dad combined. And she's 24 years old. And I have a family, and I'm very proud of my family too. That's one thing we missed. Let's see. Oh, and I play in a amplified ensemble, if you will. We call it a rock band if we were in the 70s, but anyway, amplified ensemble. And started off being pretty much just a hobby. I've been playing in really terrible cover bands for 25 years just because I can, you know, and I like to, and something you do with your friends. But my latest iteration, this guy showed up who's just an amazing songwriter, an amazing singer, and he turned us from like about as average as you could be to pretty good an ensemble. And so I'm really looking forward to expanding on that because we will have our first public performance in about 2 months. We've been putting it together in the studio, and we're looking forward to taking that out. Well, not on the road, but at least out of the studio. So that is that. If I'm an average musician, it's only after years of struggle, but I do enjoy playing with my friends, and right now I'm very happy with the group that I'm in, which is, by the way, called the Quorum, Quorum, Quorum. And it was harder to come up with a name than it was to write a song. Who knew? But anyway. That's my other thing, my family, my musical ambitions, which are very modest. And I can't think of much else.
If you could think of one thing to say to anybody, that would pretty much, you know, I know this is a difficult question, but
If I was a tree.
if you could, somebody young may be listening to this at some
Okay.
point, it's always nice to have a little sage advice or communication. You know, talk about quorum, that's
Yes.
communication. What would you say to anybody listening to this, you know, the closing of this interview about what you in your life, what you've learned so far?
Well, it's clear to me, and apparently to you also, that my passion for whatever I'm doing is extreme, and I don't have any way of quantifying that with anyone else. But, you know, do whatever the passion is, you know, because and unfortunately, one of my passions has not been making money. But I find that the people whose passion is only that have nothing else in their life, you know. And my passion is everything but making money. And I have had an amazing adventure, and I have no idea whether I was just lucky or whether I was gifted. I just know that the adventure was great.
Driven by your, and I guess I would say with you that quite an adventure. Adventure and passion and excitement, and I
Well,
mean, you've
I
lived
will
a
say
large
this.
life.
I tell people that I had the greatest bicycle adventure of the 20th century. This is no longer the 20th century, but of the last century, I can't imagine anyone who had a better adventure because a lot of people are better bike riders. There's no doubt about that, and I wasn't much as a racer, but the things that I took part in changed the world. And once again, I don't claim to have directed all that stuff. I know that I did take part, you know, I'll leave it to others to define whether I have personal gifts or just got lucky.
Well, that certainly is a very big adventure. So
Yes.
we'll close on that.
All right.
Thank you so much for your time and for your stories and for your
Oh, well,
sharing.
too bad you're cutting me off 6 hours early, but anyway, I appreciate this very much. Thank you.